Firm was joined by Daniel Clay, a vocal collector and musician. Since then, Conductar has provided master tape transfers for NSYNC Laboratories, the Albert Coates Heritage, Ritornello Records, and most recently, the Metropolitan Opera Guild and Chuan Chalpa. Both Bart Gumbel and Daniel Hodick today will speak to us and play musical examples in a program entitled A High-Tech Capsule History of Recorded Sound.
Well, to begin with, we play records rather than talking about them or documenting them. So if you don't like to listen to records, this hour will probably not be for you. As private individuals, I'd like to say that we do not have, from Rodgers and Hammerstein here since 1981, and his scientific approach is the one we have adopted. Our expertise that we've added, I think, to Tom's groundwork has been our expertise in pressing and knowledge of the record and music material. Our greatest secret, of course, is in our nationwide network of private collectors, where we have access to, at this point, virtually every record that we've attempted to obtain, particularly for the Met Opera Guild sets. Some of the demands of which have been fairly extensive. But everything is a bit subjective, and as was said about Charles II, one man's restoration is another man's debauchery. Or if you ride the New York buses, I might say one man's transfer is another man's detour. So what we're saying is all sound is to some extent subjective. Perhaps the reasons that we followed Tom Owen into the jungle is because Tom doesn't believe in subjectivity. We try not to, but we are interested in the musical material, and to us the mechanical means of reproducing it is merely a way of being able to let it be heard by the widest number of people. The early history of the phonograph is a history of the voice. So the first part of the program will be devoted to the vocal material, and I introduce my partner and vocal expert in the firm, Daniel Clay.
Good morning. The voice is something I don't have very much of. Brings up a bad cold. I'm known as the vocal member of Conductar, but I'm not going to say very much today. This is a conference for the Association of Recorded Sound Collections. I'm for less conference, obviously, and more recorded sound. Anything that I can offer to you people is going to be contained in the tape and not on anything I might say about it. The history of vocal music basically concerns itself with the unique voices, which are like unique faces, past of time. There are also many attempts to preserve someone's favorite interpretation, whether the artists or composers or just the publics. The seven selections I've chosen certainly contain some of the most powerful voices that have been recorded this century. I have chosen things, for the most part, which are quite famous, so that those of you who already have experienced a particular voice will know, at least in some sense, what other transfers are available and what you know from the past. And for your information, I've also appended the speed I've used to transfer each recording on the program. The program goes for 40 years exactly, from 1901 to 1941. The first selection is to be announced.
Vecino, máquina dentro, para la chavilla tirar un ratito.
Thank you. Come, What was the date of that?
1904, I believe.
It's the late death. There's another one, isn't there?
There's only one.
These are 12 years.
Yes, yeah, well, this is one of the 12. I think there were multiple takes of each. I'm sorry, I think there were multiple takes of both the 25 and 30 centimeter.
Francisco,
we can't answer questions during the program because we're going to run late. Maybe afterwards we'll be glad to.
Thank you. The first two recordings, of course, both had piano accompaniments, and acoustic recordings were by no means confined to limited performing forces. The next selection has an unbelievably large orchestra and organ, but apparently they had to strip out a chorus because Shelley often sneaks off to the side and sings the chorus responses himself. And this is also interesting because in an acoustic recording, you can hear a sense of vocal perspective, which is certainly something that they tried to do from the very earliest times. Mikhailova is generally looked down upon by American collectors because all of her records were 10-inch records issued on the Dollar Cheap Red Label series. Totally best in black. Totally not unjustifiably. Anyone who can find me a nice copy of the Demon Aria, I'll be glad to have it.
Oh!
real church and do a real contralto. This, I think, is one of Clara Butt's exceptional records. It has her loudest and her softest singing. She takes a piece of music which is fairly worthless and invests it with so much sincerity that you almost want to believe it. This material, however, is not for everyone. It's the height of Victorian religiosity. A remarkable thing about great voices, and Butts is certainly one, is that they retain their texture at all levels of volume, and no matter how high or how low, it's still, there's that center, that core. And in this particular electrical recording, at a fairly advanced age, she was able still to do it. I think it's always been appropriate, I've always thought it appropriate that Clara Butt was on the purple label. It seems a color that's so suited to her. It's a shame she had to share it. I put down the speed of this record at 77.9 RPM because I'm in principle against records that play at 78 and I can't tell the tenth of an RPM difference anyway. 78 seems to me to mean only a group of records that play at anything except that speed. Clara Butt.
Thank you.
One of the great things about colored torch show pieces is that they are utterly without redeeming social value, and you're allowed just to enjoy them. In this case, the voice is used absolutely as an instrument, and I suppose you would call it a piccolo d'amour or piccolo du chasse or something. Obviously, there was a rehearsal discussion where Albert Wolff got all the soloists, including Claire Bear, together and said, now look, this is how we're going to do this. And the sense of ensemble here is nothing short of remarkable. Notice in particular a descending chromatic motive, which is just tossed from soloist to soloist, and a great deal of imitative work going on between voice and orchestra. This is one of the best examples I know of what's called the polydor sound, where a large orchestra is placed in an even larger room, and there is a tremendous feeling of spaciousness and freedom. I would like to dedicate this playing to the memory of Arthur Naftal, who was the late president of the VRCS. Arthur first played this record for me, I guess about 10 years or 11 years ago, and unfortunately Arthur died of AIDS in June. I enjoy it. who could probably sing louder, or actually who could produce more sound pressure than anybody else, is still not a loud tenor, and I think this record proves why. As with Butt and with Claire Bear, the voice retains that core to the softest viola. And his diction is quite good. However, when he gets to the part proper, he seems to make up some words. By the time you get there, you don't care. It's just that he's gorgeous singing. Phrases like "a sun bursting through clouds" are not anywhere near sufficiently poetic to describe the way he says, he's old and he's true, this too. reasons, the last people ran over a little, we're running a little bit late. I'm going to not play the last selection, which turns out segues very well into Bard's program. Thank you.
We'll reload this tape recorder as quickly as possible. It was very difficult for me to decide how to do a capitalized history of recording the orchestra. It would have been possible, of course, to have picked orchestral showpieces from virtually any period and any recording company, but I thought perhaps it would be very interesting to follow from 1908 on the attempts to capture the Wagner orchestra. As we know, Wagner has always been not only a staple, but perhaps a fixation of recording companies since the very beginning. Not probably because sales certainly would have justified a great deal of it, but I think Wagner exerted, particularly in the first part of the 20th century, still exerted a sort of mysticism that we perhaps, having gone through two world wars, have debunked. I think the interesting part of it is that the first, and I'm not speaking absolutely accurately because I do not have a Wagner orchestral discography that is by any means complete, but one of the first examples that I found was, of all things, not by a German orchestra or a German conductor at all, but by the redoubtable Carlo Sabaino and the La Scala Orchestra from 1908. This is, as the record label says, is from Tristan y Isolda, and it's the Morte de Isolda, and the way it's played possibly will suggest something like it should have been called the Morte de Lucia. However, it's interesting that even at this period, 1908, there was an attempt to record purely Wagnerian orchestral excerpts without vocal participation. So the first thing we'll hear when this is ready is a section. I'm not really playing anything complete at all. We're going to hear just a section of this 1908 La Scala Sabaino Liebestod. Recording a complete Beethoven Fifth was probably an adventurous and commercially hazardous idea at the time, disregarding the fact that Pinkish was probably the most famous conductor of his time. However, what is very interesting, and I think you may be surprised a bit by this, in August 1913, before Pinkish ever recorded any of that material, there was an attempt made in Berlin under the direction of Alfred Hertz, the conductor from the Met, who violated the principles of Bayreuth by conducting the first performance in 1903 of Parsifal at the Met. There was an attempt to record, and they did record, 8 sides of Parsifal in August 1913. And we're going to hear a bit of the transformation scene. Now, if you know the score, you know that this is a pretty enormous undertaking to try and cram what appears to be a fairly full-sized Wagner orchestra and the Bayreuth bells, you'll notice they are not tubular chimes, into a recording horn. And this is part of the transformation scene. It would have been very easy to have made this next short excerpt shocking in that I'm going from acoustic to electric recording. But I thought it would be very interesting, and I looked around for quite some time to find the nearest match I could in terms of date and conductor and recording location, and the same piece, obviously, to illustrate the difference between the very latest acoustic techniques, that is 1924, and the very first electrical technique. It's not nearly as shocking as you think. Tom and I have done some work on the BADAP to establish the difference in frequency response, but I think the ear will tell you that, especially in the same room that it was recorded. So what we're going to hear is this. It's the Prelude to Act III of Lohengrin with Albert Coates. The acoustic was made October 22, 1924 in Hayes Studio B. The electric was made October 27, 1925, so there's just very little more than a year's difference, again in the same studio. The only difference in the orchestral disposition, by the way, between the acoustic and electric is that the acoustic has 12 strings and 17 strings were allotted to the electric. Thank you. fade that clarinet up quick. If a date can be established for the recording of a Wagnerian orchestra that would go down in history in terms of the listenability of the records, there is very little question what that date is. It is January 26, 1926, and it happened in the Queen's Hall. It was again Mr. Coates, but he was allowed 42 strings this time and a full complement of an orchestra. It was also the first time he had been recording outside of Hayes in a concert hall. The fact that this was an initial effort produced some of the most amazing recordings that we have in the Wagner repertoire. In one single day, they recorded releasable sides of the Magic Fire music, the Rhine Journey, the funeral music, the prelude and the entry of the gods to Rheingold, the Rite of the Valkyries, and the Tristan prelude. Not bad for a day. It began with a sunrise. What you've been listening to is the attempt to capture a symphony orchestra in a hall. I think relatively ungimmicked, except perhaps for some game writing. There seems to be no receding or obvious multi-microphone. But by 1930, the second generation of Westrex material equipment had made it possible to record a much higher level on the 78 itself. And compression of signal resulted, of course, in a much higher level throughout most of the records. And therefore, on the phonographs of the day, the material sounded much better. Obviously, that was the beginning of recording records to sound good on contemporary phonographs. Notice, if you will, in this Bayreuth 1930 excerpt from Tannhäuser under Carl Elmendorf, notice how certain instruments are highlighted. The castanets at the very beginning, or claves, whatever they are, and solo strings. This is part of the Bacchanal from Tannhäuser from the summer of 1930 at Bayreuth. Sorry to cut that off, but we're running short, and I certainly don't want to cheat the last person on this program, because I don't see Mr. Farrell from the Tuscanini Archives, but I'm sure he'd be very unhappy if I omitted him. On April 9th, 1936, the final recording session was held in Carnegie Hall with the New York Philharmonic. Under Arturo Toscanini, and the subsequent release of a Wagner album is another one of those instances where we don't know whether we're listening to truth or whether we're listening to commercial truth. It was said that the Wagner album recorded with the Philharmonic under Toscanini sparked a new revival in interest in recorded orchestral repertoire, but lagging sales due to the Depression were suddenly the spurt in sales was accredited to this album. I don't know whether that's really true or not, and I'm not sure it makes any difference at this point. But I think that there's no question that we're hearing an orchestra in its natural milieu with one of the greatest conductors. I thought it was also interesting that we started in 1908 with an Italian, and we might as well end in 1936. This is the Dawn, not the Dawn, I'm sorry, this is the Rhine Journey. Thank you.
Distinct change in the sound of the 78s. Mr. Hamilton and I have long discussions as to the pros and cons of, of digital transfers, but that will give you some idea of the work that we're presently doing. Thank you, and I hope you've enjoyed the program. And I would like to say just one more thing, and that is my thanks to my collector friends Bill Poulos and Don Kane for making this material possible.